Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. A study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association earlier this year found that for the first time in a decade, overdose deaths among teens in the United States rose dramatically in 2020 and kept rising through 2021 as well. Researchers found that fatal overdoses among adolescents nearly doubled from 492 in 2019 to 954 in 2020, an increase of 94%. There was an additional 20% rise in 2021 compared to the previous year. Those who die from overdose often have a history of non-fatal overdoses. Yet once a person reaches the age of 18, families are not automatically notified of an overdose, even if that person has been treated in a hospital. Many parents only learn of their child's overdose when they receive insurance or hospital bills. Substance use disorder and overdose is an epidemic impacting people of all ages. But on today's program, we focus on the teen and young adult population. How can we improve treatment of 18 to 24-year-olds who have suffered a non-fatal overdose and prevent them from overdosing again? With us is Nancy Reagan, Director of the Substance Use Disorder Program at the Community Health Center of Cape Cod. Welcome. Good to see you again.
Thank you. Good to see you.
And also with us is Leah McDonald, ER physician at Falmouth Hospital. Welcome, Dr. McDonald.
Hey, thanks for having me.
One of the things we're seeing a lot of, Dr. McDonald, is it's fentanyl, right? That's the cause of many of these overdoses. So tell us a little bit about fentanyl and why this is happening.
Yeah, so I guess this goes into the background of what we were typically seeing for overdoses. So specifically, we're thinking about opiate overdoses. So opiate overdoses typically lead to respiratory depression, and that is the leading cause of death from them. When we see this, it's typically when people take too much of a medication or a drug. With fentanyl is much more concentrated, much stronger, much more potent than the typical opiates that we would see, such as heroin or oxycodone or methadone. So even a little bit of that, when someone doesn't know that they're taking that, can lead to a fatal overdose. It's become much more potent and available.
Yeah, very dangerous, right? Nancy, tell us a little bit about this rise we're seeing in overdose deaths. It's dramatic. So are we seeing fentanyl showing up in other recreational drugs as marijuana? Tell us a little bit about what we're seeing.
We are, yes. When we treat patients, we often do urine toxicology screens. I think maybe 5-6 years ago, we're seeing a lot of heroin analog. We're really not seeing any anymore. It's predominantly fentanyl. As Dr. McDonald said, it is a highly potent opioid. We are on Cape Cod seeing adulterated pills and other powders. An individual might think they're buying cocaine, they might think they're buying something other than an opioid, and what they're getting is fentanyl. So, and if they are, particularly if they're not frequent or consistent opioid users, they're at an extremely high rate of fatal overdose.
Yeah. Dr. McDonald, as an emergency room physician, in the event of an ER visit, what determines what next of kin is notified and how overdose historically has been communicated to a family? Is it changing? Is it, what's happening there?
Yeah, that's a great question. Typically, when people come in after an opiate overdose, thanks to Narcan, people are usually awake and alert. So we usually communicate with the patient themselves about who they want informed. Most people are getting treatment in the field by EMS or bystanders. When people come in and they're unresponsive, if we are unable to revive them, we would let next of kin know. But as I said, because of the advent of a life-saving drug, we usually address the person themselves about who they want to be told.
Nancy, what's happening to a person physically when overdosing? Why do they stop breathing?
So as Dr. McDonald alluded to, the opioid has, any opioid even prescribed after surgery or for acute pain, has the potential to cause respiratory depression. And so essentially the breathing has become so slow that they are not oxygenating, and they become depleted of oxygen. In severe cases, they will stop respirating. Follow-up question was...
I was just wondering, what happens, why is it breathing?
Yes.
Dr. Narcan, how does Narcan reverse the process?
Yeah, so Narcan is an opiate antagonist. So the way that works is as the opiates go and hit all of the receptors in the body, Narcan goes and knocks those all off. So it reverses the effects of the opiates across the body. And the main thing that we're looking for when we use it in the ED is reversing the respiratory depression.
How does the process of overdosing and then being treated with Narcan impact the brain?
So the opiate overdose itself, when you're not breathing, your oxygen levels are going down and your carbon dioxide levels are going up in the brain. So those two things are going to lead to a time when your brain is not getting enough oxygen. So they're almost like miniature hypoxic injuries, which is something that happens when someone has a cardiac arrest. So this is like a death experience to the brain. It's a huge experience to the brain.
Yeah. So Nancy, what about, revival, the emotional, we were talking about what's happening to the brain, the physical and emotional impact, and how long do people experience these feelings?
Yeah, I think there's two important things to consider post-overdose, right? So, when we or bystanders or EMTs administer Narcan, immediately they're coming out of, first of all, this place of serenity because the opioid euphoria just kind of feels like a peaceful sleep. So they're jolted awake, which is rather unpleasant. And then they're immediately without that opioid. And so what that means for someone who's using opioid consistently is they're immediately in physical withdrawal. So they immediately feel sick. It could be nausea, vomiting, sweating, pain, cramping, often followed by diarrhea. It's extremely unpleasant. It's probably akin to the worst flu you'll ever feel. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, they're jarred awake. There's often people standing over them. I think it must be very terrifying. And then in the minutes to hours and days following, again, there's that emotional factor that you're talking about that, my goodness, I almost died. And, I think there's tons of guilt and shame and embarrassment. And I think it's a whole slew of negative things.
Is it common for someone who's overdosed to want to use again to help them feel better? I mean, you're saying they're feeling all this, so that's like, if I use again, I'm going to feel better?
Absolutely. And so that's the surefire way to make those physical symptoms feel better. People who are using opioids consistently aren't doing it much for the high after they've been using for a period of time. They're really trying to stave off that physical withdrawal. So yes, absolutely. They know the absolute cure to this is going to be an opioid.
Yeah. So what does the data tell us about the likelihood of someone having another overdose in the days, weeks, or months following that overdose?
There was a study that showed that 5% of patients who initially survive an overdose succumb to a fatal overdose within 1 year. This is where I kind of start talking about medications, because if we start talking about offering methadone, buprenorphine, we can, at that 12-month time period, we will see a decrease of fatality by 53% with methadone and 37% with buprenorphine or Suboxone.
Yeah. Anything you want to add to that, Dr. McDonald? I see you nodding your head.
Well, I was thinking about your question about do people typically want to use drugs after an overdose, and we very typically see people who after an overdose are very anxious to leave the emergency department. So we typically monitor people depending on what we think they've overdosed on, around 2 to 4 hours is the to make sure that the Narcan is worn off and that they're still awake and alert. But people very typically want to leave before that. Mm-hmm. And most of that, I think, is driven by the anxiety and the withdrawal that they're feeling.
Yeah. So you're saying pretty much standard ER treatment is 2 to 4 hours following a non-fatal dose. Is that for everybody, even, these 18 to 24-year-old range?
Yep. We don't change things based on age. I'd say the resources given depend on where you are and what time of day. So obviously I trained at an academic center where there were social workers and people available all times of day. And you would get people into kind of recovery specialists and things like that. In our system, if people want help, if people want to get into detox or want to get into with a recovery specialist, we are more than happy to keep them in the overnight hours or have them speak to the social worker during the day. But if people do not want help, at this point, there's no law or any type of onus on the system to force people to get help or tell anybody.
Let's look to Eric, who's giving us a call from East Hampton. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, and thanks for having this dialogue, as it's certainly much needed and it's always helpful. I guess my question is talking about how a person who experiences a non-fatal overdose is much more likely to have a fatal overdose in the days or weeks to follow. As an attending physician, can you section a patient who wants to leave the hospital and kind of order them to stay because of their lack of clear judgment and mindset following an overdose? I know that kind of hinges on civil liberties often, but I know we take away people's rights, you know, if they're intoxicated, whether driving a car. We don't allow them to drive, so we take those rights away. Is there any way a physician has that capability?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are laws in place. So you're talking about sections, which are legal standards and laws that allow us to say that a person is a risk to themselves or others. And we typically impose those in cases of mental illness. So people that are suicidal or homicidal or such, manic. Right now there is a law that's called a Section 35, which typically is imposed by, we do that on patients, but it's typically done through the help of our social worker in the courts in terms of getting someone into substance use help if they're a threat to themselves because of their use. Unfortunately, that typically comes as a when we see it's happened repeatedly for a person, which, you know, as you said, is flawed, because if we're repeatedly seeing someone having issues with opiates, especially non-fatal overdoses, the possibility that their next one could be a fatal one is very high. Mm-hmm. So the system is pretty flawed in our ability to do that.
Yeah, go ahead, Nancy.
Yeah, I just also want to comment on that. Early in my career, I provided treatment in these Section 35 centers. And it's, you know, I provided from a DPH licensed unit, and we provided healthcare and medical detox and referral for services, of course, because really the important thing here is long-term services. You know, Dr. McDonald and her team are providing that acute care in that acute moment where there's, you know, imminent risk, and then as often sending folks to us for the long term. But just to comment on the Section 35, that it's also an imperfect system, right? So if there are no beds in the Department of Public Health units, what often ends up happening, because they can't let the individual go, is they end up serving out that sentence, if you will. It's not an appropriate term, but that treatment mandate in a jail cell. Mm. So it can be less than ideal. And because individuals know that, sometimes they are hesitant to go to places where they're fearing being sectioned.
Yeah. I have an email from a listener who says, my son overdosed on May 11th, 2019. He was taken by Boston EMS to Boston Medical Center. They, the EMT, used 3 nasal Narcan and were unable to revive him. They had to use an IV and a major artery with Narcan to bring him back. This was a life-threatening overdose. He went into the emergency room. He was offered services and left 2 hours later. It's a known fact that he can re-overdose after the Narcan effect dissipates within 24 hours. My son died of a fatal overdose. I believe if there is legislation put in place that when someone overdoses, they are held for 24 hours, it would have been a piece of legislation with details. She said it was tough to, I guess, detail, you know, put out this legislation. My perfect scenario would be they would be held in the emergency room for 24 hours. An attendant or guard would be seated outside the room. Within those 24 hours, they would be contacted every 6 hours by the social worker and substance use disorder program. Each time the social worker visits them, he or she would offer services and would request that they sign a release so that the social worker would be able to contact a loved one, be that a family member or someone they trust, so somebody knows that they are in the hospital and have had a serious overdose. I know that Governor Charlie Baker developed legislation that included a 72-hour hold, and it was rejected in the Senate. I believe the 72-hour hold was too long a time and logistically would be difficult to enact. 24 hours in the emergency room seems so much more doable to me. I believe if this was in place, my son would be alive today. Thanks to your attention to this very important subject. So sorry for your loss. And what do you think about that, Dr. McDonald? Is that doable?
It is doable. It's similar to what we do for psychiatric patients. I think the the main issue that we have when we take care of somebody is if they really don't want to be there. Because, you know, when we are taking care of someone that does not want to be in the hospital and we're keeping them there against their will, we have to do things to keep them there against their will. So it becomes a very controversial topic, and people fall on different lines of whether or not, you know, we should be keeping these people there against their will. It is definitely doable. And I think that if we, you know, what I try to do is more make sure that we're treating any underlying withdrawal that's happening in the patient and, you know, develop a relationship with them to try to help, you know, make sure that they feel trusted and that we are helping them. And if people, you know, with that approach are still not wanting treatment, you know, right now it's not in our purview to keep them, but I think it is doable if that was a law.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing how to improve supports and services for young adults following an overdose. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. With us is Nancy Reagan, Director of the Substance Use Disorder Program at the Community Health Center of Cape Cod, and Dr. Leah McDonald, ER physician at Falmouth Hospital. Dr. McDonald, we think, you know, of treatment for substance use disorder as inpatient care, but what are the immediate treatment options that physicians in the ER have at their disposal?
Yeah, so when we are talking about treatment, we're talking about two things. We're talking about immediate treatment of withdrawal symptoms, as well as long-term treatment of opiate use in order to prevent further use. So right now, there are two medications that are typically used for this. One is methadone and one is buprenorphine. The trade name that most commonly people know that by is Suboxone. Methadone is an opiate. So it's similar to the opiate that they're using, but it typically does not cause the euphoria or high of something like a heroin. And it's used for maintenance therapy and you take it daily. The major issue with that is that most people have to go daily to a program to get that medication. It also does have a lot of diversion issues because it can be used at higher doses to cause euphoria and can be lethal. More commonly being used and is medication called buprenorphine, so Suboxone, which is a partial agonist, which means that while it also replaces an opiate like heroin, it also blocks some of those effects. So it's much safer. It is much less likely to cause respiratory depression. It's also usually cut with another medication so that it can't be diverted to be abused. And it also can be prescribed so people can get doses and take it at home and they don't need to go daily to a program to get it.
Yeah, go ahead, Nancy.
Just to follow up on that, you know, you initially asked the question that that people typically picture inpatient treatment for substance use disorder. And I think while that's true, it's actually not the case, right? I think of that in the acute stage, like Dr. Leah and Dr. McDonald and her team, the detox centers. Evidence shows if we don't start these medications, even at a detox, once we let somebody go, they're still at increased risk for overdose. These medications can really reduce the risk for overdose and improve outcomes. Patients followed 12 months after being on these medications have 90% toxicology negative for illicit substance use.
Dr. Mitchell, how well trained are ER, you know, staff and physicians to treat substance use disorder, and are we seeing changes there?
Yeah, great question. We're definitely seeing changes, even within my time in residency. So I'm 3 years out of residency. We received training towards the end of our residency. So people that are in training now are getting more training on how to treat substance use disorder. And within our own system, this is now becoming part of mandates within our ERs across the country that physicians know how to do this. So at Falmouth Hospital, we're working to implement programs to be able to prescribe buprenorphine for patients that come in after an overdose or in withdrawal in order to get them to the community health centers for long-term treatment.
Yeah. Let's talk to Megan, who's giving us a call from Centerville. Good morning, Megan.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
I just wanted to give my limited experience in the ER, my opinion on 24-hour holds, as was a patient's mom's suggestion. I don't know if that is logistically something that is feasible by staffing to have somebody present with them for a 24-hour hold when there are so many psych, pediatric psych especially, holds in the ERs recently.
Yeah.
And also just to support antagonist medications. And also a great resource would be Ryan Marino on Twitter. He's a great voice, a physician who supports recovery and, you know, the resources for people that might be interested in that.
Yeah. Megan, thank you. Thanks for calling. Appreciate that. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Let's kind of talk a little bit about the role legislation could play if we're keeping 18 to 24-year-olds with substance use disorders safe. Individuals can stay on their parents' insurance to age 24. Should parents have access to more information about the healthcare needs of their children if they're financially responsible? What are your thoughts on that? Why or why not? And could this be legislated? I'd love to hear from listeners too, but Dr. McDonald, what do you think about that?
Yeah, so there are a lot of situations in place where we think of patients as independent from their parents. So for example, pregnancy is one that we do not need to inform a parent if a patient is pregnant. And it obviously is not a perfect system because, as you said, they are still on their parents' insurance. But the logistics of those significant laws are so much different in the day-to-day situation that you're in. So I typically have a conversation with my patient. You know, they're a person in front of you. Your parents are going to know that you're pregnant. Their parents are going to know that this is happening.
Yeah.
And the same is true with an overdose. You know, I always ask people, what does their support system look like? Who's there for you? And most people will say things that, you know, you can encourage a conversation to tell them about what is going on. You know, there are exceptions to the laws to let loved ones or family know about overdoses. So if they're incapacitated, as you know, unconscious or something like that, or if you feel like they're a threat to themselves or others, and that gets into that gray area that we were talking about before, about what that situation would be.
Nancy, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, just, you know, I think about it even in terms of primary care. So I provide primary care at Community Health Center as well. And when we provide care for adolescents, as Dr. McDonald said, there are certain topics that we leave parents out of. And that's, you know, contraception, STDs, substance use treatment. And I think the reason for that is because we want that open and honest dialogue with an adolescent or a young adult that may not happen if they think we're going to be sharing with parents. So I think these laws in Massachusetts were enacted to drop down barriers of these young people coming to us to seek relationships and seek care.
You can imagine a parent's so surprised when all of a sudden they get this hospital bill, or you know that they didn't know this happened. And yeah,
so we typically actually say that if you're using your insurance, this might come home to mom in an envelope. So
yeah, what are those conversations like, Nancy? I mean, you know, what's the reaction? I mean, I can see where the adolescent might be, well, I don't want my parents to know, right? But you know, they're going to. So how do you advise them to have this conversation with their parents?
I mean, we can always, I have to be honest, even in treating adults and young adults, these conversations with family members are so challenging. We're always happy to help navigate these conversations. We're always happy. You know, the medications themselves come with a stigma, unfortunately. And so a lot of families are fearful of them starting the medication. So we always offer the help if they want to have a consult with us. Mm-hmm. If we can give them advice as to how to open up these conversations, we try to help.
Dr. McDonald, do you come across that in the ER with young people encouraging conversations with their families, or is that a little bit beyond what you're doing in the ER?
Yeah, no, well, you know, unfortunately, I think by the time they're coming to see us in the ER, family members typically know that someone has a problem. I think I'm very rarely, you know, the first person that's seen someone for their opiate use if they're coming to the ER for it.
Yeah. So does insurance offer adequate coverage for those with substance use disorder, especially those who've not had a fatal overdose, to ensure access to, you know, quality and timely treatment? And if not, is there a role for legislation to mandate that?
I mean, I can speak to the outpatient piece of it. We rarely have difficulty getting our treatment provided, covered by insurances. Medicaid is usually exceptional for that. Some of the more expensive medications, like medication called Vivitrol, some of the injectable monthly medications, medication called Sublocade, which is buprenorphine injected, are a little pricey, and sometimes some of the insurances or the private insurances are hesitant to pay for that.
Yeah, I see we have Senator Julian Sear joining us on Zoom. Senator Sear, are you there? Maybe we don't.
Good morning.
Oh, good morning. So I don't know if you've been listening to this conversation, but we'd love to have your input on legislation, anything that might be pending, or your thoughts on what we could help as far as supports and services for these young adolescents who are young adults, I should say, who are, you know, suffering with substance use disorder.
So good morning. It's good to be with you and. You know, thank you, especially to Amy, you know, who's talking about some of the one of the toughest things that someone can imagine, right? Which is losing a child and losing a child to addiction, to an overdose. You know, there's a lot we're trying to do here, and in part because what COVID-19 and the COVID-19 pandemic has done is really sort of took all the sort of gaps and cracks that we had in our healthcare system and in a whole host of health outcomes and really exacerbated them. So, you know, we've seen, you know, even nationally, you know, in 2019, there were 492 adolescent overdose deaths nationally. In 2020, there were 954. That's a 94% increase. And this is a bit of an equity issue too, if you look at who this is affecting. Indigenous youth, youth of color, certainly LGBTQ youth and queer youth. And what's alarming here is that substance use among teens has actually gone down. And so what we think is that the actual rise in overdose deaths seems to be a result of the presence of fentanyl, which is pretty ubiquitous increasingly in the drug supply, yes, in heroin and now in a number of other drugs. And we think that is in part really driving this increase in overdose that we're seeing among adolescents and certainly the wider population. So we've got a lot that we're trying to do here, much of which is about harm reduction. And I can talk about that if you'd like, but really trying to take a harm reduction approach to save lives.
But before we get to that, let me ask you, we had a parent who suggested this 24-hour hold. Like, I guess, you know, a while back we had where the governor's idea was a 72-hour hold, that maybe that was too long. What about a 24-hour hold for somebody who's had a non-fatal overdose? Is that something that is, it, you know, legislators are even discussing or talking about? Or what are your thoughts on that?
So this is in conversation in the legislature. It's actually a bill that's pending before my committee. So I'm not supposed to, if I'm supposed to be making a recommendation on a bill and get to take action on it.
Tell us what the idea is. You don't have to tell us your opinion, but tell us what is it that you're discussing.
The idea is, you know, when you have someone who has an overdose, right, and they're able to be revived, right, that there's Narcan, that they're able to get to the hospital, right. That is an opportunity to get that person into treatment. And the data really shows that what happens in the period of time, a certain period of time after that overdose, can be really determinative in someone's outcomes going forward, right? Can you get them into treatment? We know that actually getting into treatment is episodic in many ways. People have to try a few times, right? There's a whole series of in the recovery process of relapse and such. And so the idea is that, you know, look, if you just were able to keep someone for a certain period of time, 24 hours, 72 hours, that will give healthcare providers and families an opportunity to get people into treatment. What can happen is, you know, you present in the emergency department, you're revived from the overdose, your physical conditions are taken care of. And then you can be released. And often what happens is that, you know, right after right after that, that's the period that people are most likely to use. So the thinking is that if we can just keep people a little longer, we can get people into treatment, and we can, this is the thinking of the bill, and we can save more lives.
So tell us a little bit about your thoughts on harm reduction.
I mean, so harm reduction really is, you know, this approach that says, look, we got to be honest about human behavior. This is actually an approach that was pioneered, you know, largely in the HIV/AIDS epidemic, and very much comes from a queer public health, you know, background. And the idea really is that, you know, we should be meeting people where they are. We should be honest about human behavior, and anything we can do to reduce the risk of serious injury, and the transmission of infectious disease and death, we should pursue. You know, so examples of harm reduction range from, you know, fentanyl test strips and other tests. In the case of opioids, right, there's a whole harm reduction sphere in sexual health that we can talk about on another show. But in the substance use arena, harm reduction includes, you know, drug testing equipment like fentanyl test strips or other drug testing equipment. So people who are using are able to know what's present in their drugs. There's a number of other kind of ideas around needle exchange, right, as a harm reduction strategy. You know, providing naloxone and overdose education, you know, kits, counseling, peer support specialists and services, that's harm reduction. You know, and the list goes on. What we've been trying to do is really direct resources, significant resources, to harm reduction. These are traditionally activities that are not reimbursed by insurance. And so we're trying to figure out a way to bolster those, because we know that harm reduction saves lives.
Is the presence of fentanyl a game changer here in how we need to step up supports, especially for those who we know are using from their non-fatal overdose? They might not have a second chance.
Yes, the presence of fentanyl and its ubiquity in the drug supply, not only just in, I mean, when we talk about heroin, right, like heroin, it's pretty difficult to get pure heroin in New England. It sort of doesn't exist. What you're actually talking about is a substance that may have a little heroin in it, but it's fentanyl based and has a lot of other kind of substances in it. But we're not just talking about heroin fentanyl. We're talking about fentanyl being present in cocaine. We're also talking about the increased use of poly substance use, meaning someone may be using an opioid and also using a stimulant. We've actually just wrapped up a commission all about methamphetamine and stimulant use in Massachusetts that I was a member of, because we're trying to get a handle on, all right, how do we respond to people who have poly substance use or who maybe have addiction to stimulants, the sort of interventions that you use for someone who has an addiction to stimulants is very different than opioids or is different in some ways. And so we want to make sure the state and our policies and programs and the programs that we're funding are responsive to that. But fentanyl really is, fentanyl has just made it so much harder to save lives in this epidemic, because it's so potent that it just really is what's driving, I think, the overdoses that we're seeing. And what's particularly tragic is the time period where people are most likely to use is when, after they get out of treatment, right? After getting out of the hospital, maybe they've detoxed for a bit or they're coming down, they go back to using a sort of an equivalent amount that they used before that treatment. And that's what leads to a lot of fatal overdoses,
right?
Unfortunately.
Yeah. State Senator Julian Cyr, thanks for taking a few minutes to talk with us. We really appreciate that.
Mindy, thank you. You guys are always covering these important issues, so it's an honor to be here.
Thanks. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are discussing how to improve supports and services for young adults following an overdose. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. With us is Nancy Reagan, Director of the Substance Use Disorder Program at the Community Health Center of Cape Cod, and Dr. Leah McDonald, an ER physician at Falmouth Hospital. And now joining us on the phone is Carrie Bickford. She's the newsletter editor for Support After Death by Overdose Community Solutions. Hi, Carrie. Thanks for joining us so last minute. Appreciate it.
Hi, Mindy. And Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And Carrie, also the mom who lost a son to overdose. And Carrie, you know, I'm very sorry about that. Tell us a little bit. We were talking about this before we went on the air. This just seems like the most unimaginable pain a parent could ever suffer, and something that you never really get over. And that's what you do with your outreach is talk to families who've been through this.
Yes. So after my son died, I don't know, 6 to 9 months later, I took an early retirement, and I just thought I wanted to do something to, you know, to remember him and possibly help other people who were going through what we were going through. And, you know, it's a very traumatic journey, not just when your person dies, but there's that whole, you know, 10-year journey that happens before the death. So it's very traumatic. You know, there's a lot of, like what you all have been talking about, you know, overdoses and you know, hospitalizations and, you know, illnesses as a result of drug use, and just slowly losing your child one day at a time is really how I would describe what it's like. And then there's the ultimate, you know, loss, which is when you get the news that, you know, you've lost them forever. They've lost their battle. And it's very painful, and it never goes away. But there are a lot of people that have experienced this. A lot of people, you know, peer support is a huge new sort of, I mean, you know, we've always had peer support programs like AAA and Al-Anon, but now with overdose deaths, we seem to be doing a really good job of supporting families with peer support groups all over the state of Massachusetts. Actually, on our website, we have a directory and a map, and there are meetings by Zoom. So if you really needed to talk to somebody who understood what it was like to be in your shoes on a certain day of the week, you don't have to get in your car, you know, you just have to check in. And I guess that's what I want to say is the most important thing, is like having people that understand what it's like to live with the stigma and you know, the failure of our society to really understand that this is a disease and that we need to do a whole lot more than we're doing. Even though we've made some steps, there's so much more that we need to do to reduce the number of deaths by overdose. Of course, I'd like it to be none, but at this point, I'd be happy just to see it going in the other direction.
Yeah. Nancy, what are your thoughts on that issue about the stigma that's attached? I'm sure you get this with all the families that you work with.
Absolutely. I think this is actually one of our hardest battles to fight, because not only is there, you know, widespread stigma about the disease, even about the treatments, but what happens over time is the patients that I see internalize the stigma. And so they start to see this as a moral shortcoming, or, as I said, guilt and shame are tremendous drivers in this disease. So it's so important for us to be having these conversations and battling the stigma in our communities.
Yeah. Carrie, what about guilt? I'm sure you get that from parents who somehow think, was there something I could have done, right? I mean, that's a common feeling I think a lot of parents may have. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, you really probably couldn't have done anything, but there's that guilt that you live with.
Yeah. That's probably one of the biggest conversations that we have, you know, is people feeling guilty, like maybe if I had done this, or maybe if I hadn't done that, or maybe if I had said this, or maybe if I had done something sooner. You know, there you can second guess yourself all over the place, because, you know, you want to change the outcome, basically. That's what's going on in your head, and you can't change the outcome, and you're wondering, you know, can it be changed for the next person? And the truth is that the person who has the disease has to be the most motivated person. And it's very hard to be motivated. Like we just said, they feel very, these people feel very downtrodden. They don't feel very good about themselves. So let me just use my son as an example. This is a person, this is a beautiful young man who is a, you know, National Honor Society student and a presidential scholar, and about as gentle a soul as you will find. He's just a really, really gentle person. And shortly before he died, he said to me, "I don't know. I'm not really sure I have anything to live for anymore," because he kept looking behind him. You know, I did this, I did that. And he couldn't be in the moment. And, you know, you didn't want to push him too much into the future. So you were just constantly trying to keep his head straight. And so it's a really, it's a very sad journey for everybody. And the thing about the Narcan that, you know, worries me the most is, you know, I do interview a lot of people for the newsletter, and I the harm reductionists tell me, and, you know, especially in the Boston area, I had an article about one particular person who said, you know, they took this person back 5 times in the same day.
Oh, wow.
After being revived, you know, so we need that needed to that something different needed to happen there. You know, like when Governor Baker changed the laws in 2014 for, you know, holding women, or I think maybe it was men and women, but the one I was reading about was a woman. And, you know, just holding them for, it was like 72 hours before they are released. But then we're placing all these burdens on the hospitals. It's like wherever you shift it, somebody's got a huge, you know, job.
Right.
And we haven't figured it out yet, but we need to, because I don't think it's really working. We're saving lives, but only to lose them later on. And I'd really love to know what the statistics are there, how many people who have died by overdose were revived by Narcan in the past. And I'm sure, I don't know if they're tracking that number, but I always feel like, oh, it saves a life, but what are we doing for the prevention part of it, and for the, you know, for helping people, you know, learn how to live with this disease?
Yeah. Nancy, go ahead.
I just think that, and first I didn't say I'm so sorry for your loss, and I'm so glad you're here talking about this, but I think that you're so right that we are not meeting the mark. And I feel really hopeful that we are all now, instead of operating in our silos, kind of working together. You know, Dr. McDonald and I have had conversations prior to this today. You know, all of the treatment providers, it's going to take a community effort. It's not just one answer.
Right.
And so many great answers have come up today, and I think they're all meaningful and useful, but it's actually going to be a widespread effort that I think will move the mark.
Now, Dr. McDonald, what do you think?
Yeah, I think, you know, the idea of harm reduction that Julian Sear talked about, and just hearing about, you know, the hopelessness that is kind of across the society of people who've lost somebody, I think we have an opportunity here. I want to relay hope that, you know, we are thinking about this in the medical community, and we're trying to come up with more innovative and better solutions. And we're really hoping, you know, in specifically talking about Suboxone, you know, if we can give someone a dose of Suboxone, even one dose of Suboxone before they leave the hospital, that actually will reduce their risk of dying from a fatal overdose, just having that medication in them. So we're really, there are things that are developing, and we're hoping that we have some new solutions.
Yeah, I think one of the other things here, and Nancy, you can speak to this, I think, is just the lack of access to mental health care, right? I mean, that is a huge part of this.
Absolutely. Honestly, for one comment on Dr. McDonald, that the prescription she's talking about for the 1 or 2 days is called a bridge script. And if you can think about that literally and figuratively, it's going to bridge them to me, to this outpatient care where we can all kind of wrap around. And what was your question? I'm sorry.
No, I was just talking about the access to mental health.
Oh, yeah. So that's what we think. When they come to us and they're in acute withdrawal and they really have this need and they're at risk for overdose, if we can tackle that and we can stop those cravings and stop that withdrawal with our medications, then we have this big job of, let's get you plugged into mental health, behavioral health. Let's get you primary care. Let's get you dental, for goodness sakes. Let's kind of, you know, community health center, we can offer that all in one spot. So yeah. I agree. Yeah.
Carrie, are you hopeful? I mean, there's been maybe some changes and some improvements in the system, although we're not anywhere near there yet. Are you hopeful we're moving in the right direction?
I really am. I feel like the dialogue is just really picking up, and you know, everybody's talking about it, people are listening, and the most important thing is that it needs to be everybody. It has to be all of the people who are that are affected by this disease, including the families of the people who are currently using or who have died by overdose, because we learn so much from their stories, you know. And SAMHSA, you know, funds our work, and they are certainly committed to making a difference. And, you know, as you mentioned, my work now is supporting people after a death by overdose. But we are very much in the dialogue about prevention, too. We have a lot of people who work with us who are in recovery and, you know, who can really guide the conversations by their own experiences and their own knowledge. So I just feel like it takes a village, you know, which is such a trite thing to say, but it really does take a village, and we all need to row in the same direction. I think we finally are, but I want us to row faster.
Yeah. And we should mention there are the support groups for parents who've been through this. If there are parents listening who've been through it, it's definitely helpful to connect with these other parents.
SADOD.org. Get right on there. And we offer one every day of the week, pretty much. So.
All right. Carrie Bickford. Thank you, Carrie. Thanks for being with us. So just in the last few minutes, some final thoughts on this. Dr. McDonald, just some final thoughts that you have on where we're headed and maybe what it's going to take, you know, to bring this, I guess, village together to make an impact.
Well, I think what Carrie said about, you know, thinking about her son as a person, we can talk about the logistics of it all, but every day I'm seeing patients who are people. And I really try to, if people are coming in with, you know, belly pain versus someone coming in with a substance use issue, mental health, I try to treat every person like a person, and really talk to them about what their issues are and without judgment. And I think that's the only way that we can get everybody involved, is that we start to see this as, you know, not necessarily a flaw in the person, but a disease, and how we can better approach it.
And that was a thing Carrie said too, Nancy, was that once we have to acknowledge this is a disease.
Yes, absolutely. This is a disease. This is not, as I said, a moral shortcoming. I really couldn't follow up Common with anything more perfect than what Dr. McDonald just said. We see people every day who are hurting so deeply. And if we can start with compassion, the rest will fall into place.
Okay, as Carrie was saying, with her son, all these accomplishments, yet he felt like he had nothing really to live
to
for.
Offer.
And you think about these people are hurting for many different reasons. When they come in, to get them into treatment sometimes can be difficult because they're feeling like they're not of value.
Or worth it. Absolutely. Yeah. Very much. But really, that's the rewarding piece of my work. We have people who are following with us for years with stability, with intermittent stability. It's a journey. They develop relationships with us. There's so much to be hopeful for, I think.
And we'll have links with more information about all this at our website, capeandislands.org. Nancy Regan is the director of the Substance Use Disorder Program at the Community Health Center of Cape Cod, and Dr. Leah McDonald, ER physician at Falmouth Hospital. Thank you both for being here, and thank you both for the work that you do. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.